And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep a pencil and some recycled paper handy. And we've got some more announcements coming up here. So first one is help stop congressional sneak attack on National Park snowmobile ban. Earlier this year, the National Park Service announced it would begin enforcing its regulations on recreational snowmobile use in national parks, amounting to a ban in most parks. This summer, however, the snowmobile industry pushed hard to attach a rider to the Interior Appropriations Bill to force the Park Service to continue to accommodate snowmobiles. It was defeated. However, pro-snowmobile Senator Ted Stevens, Republican from Alaska, chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, is now working to attach a similar rider to any of the remaining spending bills this week. Senator Stevens' proposed rider, which was written by a snowmobile industry attorney in Alaska, would force the Park Service to allow the noise and air pollution of snowmobiles to continue unchecked. Action. We must ensure the Clinton administration stands strong to defeat this rider. Please contact George Frampton of the Council on Environmental Quality today and urge him to support a veto of any appropriations bill that would impede the Park Service's ability to prohibit the inappropriate use of snowmobiles in national parks. Here's the contact number for George Frampton, 202-456-6224. That's 202-456-6224. And if you wanted to send him a fax, it's 202-456-2710. Once again, 202-456-2710. And in related news, on October 10th, the National Park Service released a plan to phase out snowmobile use in Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks by the winter of 2003 and 2004, and to substitute a clean and quiet mass transit system of snow coaches. Well, they might be clean, but they're not all that quiet. They do make noise, but what the hell. While the new winter use plan is a significant step in the right direction, it still fails to protect clean air, natural quiet, and wildlife for the next 3 years. Park Service is taking public comments on the plan until October 31st, and the snowmobile industry is already working hard to generate comments to weaken the plan. Send your letters in support of the plan to ensure clean air and natural quiet to the Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. Urge the Park Service to amend the winter use plan preferred alternative to include an immediate ban on snowmobile use. Send your written comments to Clifford Hawks, H-A-W-K-E-S, National Park Service, 12795 West Alameda Parkway, Lakewood, Colorado, 80228. Once again, that address, Clifford Hawks, National Park Service, 12795 West Alameda Parkway, Lakewood, Colorado, 80228. Or you could send email to yell_winter_use@nps.gov. That's yell_winter_use@nps.gov. If you'd like more information, contact Sean Smith of the Blue Water Network, 415-788-3666. That's 415-788-3666. And here's a call to prevent chip mills from destroying southern forests. The movement to stop the proliferation of chip mills and the expansion of industrial forestry in the South has seen tremendous success in the past year. Chip mills like giant pencil sharpeners grind whole trees into chips for pulp paper and particle board. The expansion of the timber industry in the South in the past 10 years accounts for all their expansion in the country. The strategy being used to address this issue is a call for state moratoriums on any new and expanding mills throughout the South, using federal and state studies on the impacts of chipping operations to generate citizens' pressure and legislative reform, challenging permits for new mills, and market-based strategies like boycotts to reduce the corporate demand for pulp paper and particle board. Missouri enacted a 2-year moratorium on new and expanding mills last April, and since then Willamette Industries is leaving the state, citing the new political climate as a reason. A 4-agency federal study of the impacts of chip mills and industrial forestry is now underway. Similar state studies are happening in Virginia, North Carolina, and ongoing in Missouri. The North Carolina study is near completion, and the Department of Environment and Natural Resources is about to make their recommendations for action by the governor. The study clearly indicates that our forests are in great danger and that we need moratoriums on new and expanded chip mills until forest protection policies are in place. Earth First Radio is asking you to call North Carolina Governor Hunt, the number 1-800-662-7952, and recommend that he immediately enact a moratorium on new and expanding chip mills in North Carolina until a comprehensive forest protection policy can be enacted. Once again, North Carolina Governor Hunt, the number 1-800-662-7952. It's time for our weekly commentary. And this one's written by Drew Sefton of the Newhouse News Service. And it's entitled, Experts Are Rethinking Advice on Near-Bear Experiences. When the grizzly charged, Patricia Van Tiegem did what hikers have already been told to do. First, she scampered up a tree, and the bear batted her down. Then she lay still on the ground playing dead, and the bear began gnawing on her face, ripping skin and muscle from her skull. Van Tiegem finally did something she wasn't supposed to do. She reached up and poked the bear in the nose, and the bear retreated. Staying still didn't work, said Van Tiegem, whose new book, The Bear's Embrace, details the grueling 20-year physical and mental aftermath of the attack on her and her husband. If I had kept playing dead, I would have been dead. And the common advice has always been and still is that if you're threatened by a grizzly, play dead. If you're threatened by a black bear, fight back. But a summer of attacks involving not only fierce grizzlies but also normally docile black bears has some experts questioning these approaches. The issue becomes more important as bear populations increase and bear and human conflicts, the term that researchers use for these sometimes violent interactions, become less rare. In late May, a black bear preyed upon a hiker, Glenda Ann Bradley, about 10 miles outside of Gatlinburg, Tennessee. It was the first recorded black bear fatality in the history of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Then, in early July, Canadian biathlete Mary Beth Miller was killed by a black bear outside Quebec City. After that, human-bear conflicts made news all summer. Black bears clawed or bit four Boy Scouts in July at the Philmont Scout Ranch in northeastern New Mexico. In August, two backpackers were charged by a bear of undetermined species in Glacier National Park in Montana. One was bitten on the thighs and hips. Also in August, in Calgary, Alberta, a man was mauled by a grizzly in the Kananaskis County of Canadian Rockies. It was the second incident in 12 hours. Those were the first attacks there in 22 years. In September, attacks have been reported in Clam Falls, Wisconsin, Hoonah, Alaska, Grand Junction, Colorado, Anchorage, McLeod Lake, British Columbia, and Yellowstone National Park. Conflict is increasing all over, said Gary Shelton, who has studied bears for 35 years and written two books considered to be the seminal works on bear aggression. What's happening is bear attacks are taking place where they haven't before. There's a higher level of fatalities, and there are more deadly attacks by black bears. Protecting people and their property from bears is a politically sensitive issue. Bears have become an icon that represent all things bad mankind has done to nature, Shelton said. New Jersey recently canceled a black bear hunt after public protest. In the last year, officials have documented 25 bear attacks on livestock and 40 on household pets. Shelton, who lives in the remote Bella Coola Valley of British Columbia, began his career as a conservationist. He came to think that bears were becoming overprotected, that populations were growing too large, so he shifted gears to study what people can do to avoid and minimize bear attacks. According to the North American Bear Society, nearly 800,000 black bears roam across Canada and all but seven American states. Grizzly numbers are harder to track, but as the bears are more elusive, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service estimates that there are 1,200 grizzlies spread throughout Montana, Idaho, Washington, and Wyoming, and 30,000 live in Alaska. University of Calgary environmental scientist Stephen Herrero, a bear expert, estimates that 60,000 brown bears, a species that includes grizzlies, live throughout North America. Statistics on bear attacks are difficult to compile. Many happen in remote wildernesses and go unreported. Herrero, author of Bear Attacks, Their Causes and Avoidance, estimated that on average bears kill 3 people and seriously injure between 5 and 15 annually in North America. Overall, the injury rates are very low considering the millions of interactions that occur each year, he added. But in August, Herrera told the Calgary Herald that the number of bear attacks this year is among the highest since biologists began keeping records 28 years ago, but specific numbers were unavailable. If people want to learn how to coexist with bears, it is incumbent upon us to figure out how they think, said Tom Smith, a research wildlife biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Alaska and an expert on bear-human interaction. Smith is studying grizzly bear responses to smells, sights, and sounds associated with human outdoor activities. He travels through the wilderness displaying different colored tent materials and playing voice recordings and noting the bear reactions. Avoidance remains the best defense, yet some people are naive about keeping bears at bay, Smith said. Campers put papaya guava honey shampoo on their heads and then wonder why bears are paying attention to them, he said. Come on, people. This is stupid. To a bear, that's about as inviting as bacon and egg shampoo would smell to a hungry hiker, Smith noted. Much of Smith's research runs counter to accepted bear avoidance tactics. He has discovered that pepper spray, a common deterrent, actually may attract bears if used incorrectly, that is, applied to tents, containers, or clothing as opposed to sprayed directly at a bear. Smith also published a study on the use of bear bells, which hikers hang from walking sticks, belts, and backpacks, and the theory that a noisy approach will keep them from catching a bear off guard. He hung a row of the noisy bells on a bush. Over time, 15 grizzly bears wandered past the bells as he rang them, and the beast didn't even twitch an ear. Some things that are taught as standard safety measures, I think, why in the world do we do that, he said. Smith sees this summer's attacks as an aberration. The overwhelming majority of bears have no desire to deal with people, he said. However, there are those Jeffrey Dahmer and Ted Kaczynski bears, like the human murderers, that set out to kill. Shelton, meanwhile, is preparing a paper on the International Bear Association conference next May that details his theory. Black bears, in certain circumstances, will indeed prey on humans. There's going to be a slow, steady increase of predatory bear attacks that will catch bear managers off guard, he predicted. Shelton pointed out that because black bears and grizzlies evolved from a common ancestor, a true predator, each species is capable of predatory attacks, so the common advice to fight a black bear and play dead for a grizzly may not hold true, particularly if the bear has targeted a human as prey. After conducting in-depth interviews with 40 survivors of attacks by bears, both blacks and grizzlies, Shelton now takes a strong position against playing dead. If the bear is deciding if you're prey and you play dead, that's exactly what happens to you, he said. He devotes a chapter in his upcoming book to the topic. So what is the best way to protect yourself in bear country? Shelton said to carry pepper spray and use it correctly. Shoot it directly at the bear and then leave the area immediately as the bear will be temporarily stunned by the burning sensation. Even though the spray's success rate runs about 75%, it is a far better strategy than the play dead and fight back concept, Shelton said. There's that old joke that how can you tell when there are grizzly bears in the area? Well, it's you find scat that has little bells and smells like pepper spray. Let's move into some more animal news here. The Environmental News Service reports that Colorado Division of Wildlife biologists are working to conserve the state's black-tailed prairie dog population to prevent its addition to the endangered species list. Currently, black-tailed prairie dogs can be hunted in Colorado and poisoned by landowners, but the Colorado Department of Wildlife is recommending a ban on hunting on public lands and a permit system that would put a yearly limit on the number of acres of prairie dog habitat where poison is used. And from the East, we read in a story titled Field Advice of Cougars in the Past by Chris Bolgiano. For decades, state and federal wildlife agencies have denied the possibility that wild cougars could exist in the eastern United States. Sightings were dismissed as deceptions or delusions, and the lack of field evidence was used to justify the official lack of concern for a species listed as endangered. The Eastern Cougar Foundation has documented 10 instances in which various items of field evidence have been confirmed by biologists. Here we go. In July of this year, a cougar was found killed by a train in Randolph County, Illinois. The necropsy, or death examination, showed normal claws, stomach contents of 100% fawn, no tattoos, and a genetic origin in the North Central American group. Since most captive cougars are declawed and or have tattoos, these facts point to a possible wild origin, or at least a recent self-sufficient past. In 1994, a cougar was killed by hunters in Missouri for the first time since the 1920s. The pelt of that animal indicated a genetic origin of the North Central American group, and witnesses remarked on the cat's long, sharp claws. In 1976, two cougars were captured in West Virginia. They were believed to be escaped captive, and one was pregnant. In Vermont in 1994, in Massachusetts in 1997, New Brunswick in Ontario, Canada, 1992 and 1999, cougar scat was collected, analyzed by various means, and found to be cougar. The Vermont incident involved a sighting of three cougars, and since cougars are generally solitary except mothers with young, this may have been a family group. In Maine in 1994, two game wardens investigating the sighting of three cats found tracks, which they stated were cougars, so this may also have been a mother with young. In West Virginia in 1998, plaster casts of tracks were confirmed in an area with a long history of cougar sightings. And in Maryland in the early 1990s, a home video was made in the Western Mountains and has since been shown many times on Maryland public TV and at biologist meetings. In the face of incontrovertible field proof, state and federal agencies have shifted the argument, claiming that any cougars in the East cannot possibly be remnant native cats, but must be occasional released or escaped captives that do not constitute a breeding population. The ECF is now forming, that's the Eastern Cougar Foundation, is now forming a field strategy for determining breeding status. Possible sources of these cats include remnant natives, escaped or released captives, and colonizers from known cougar populations in Florida and Texas. Since the spring of 1998, at least three radio-collared Florida panthers have crossed north of the Caloosahatchee River, and for the first time since fieldwork began 20 years ago. It's possible that cougars from all three sources may be interbreeding. The Eastern Cougar Foundation is working towards protected status on the state and federal levels for all cougars living wild in the East, regardless of their origins. Chris Bolgiano is the vice president of the Eastern Cougar Foundation, whose mission is to build understanding and tolerance of cougars as a native animal that plays important ecological roles. The Eastern Cougar Foundation is a 501c3 organization, was founded by West Virginian Todd Lester in 1998 to compile the accumulating scientifically verified field evidence and to grapple with related issues of legal status, habitat management, and social acceptance of wild cougars. If you'd like more information or you'd like to join the Eastern Cougar Foundation, contact Todd Lester. His email address, scb01489@mail.wvnet.edu. Once again, that address, scb01489@mail.wvnet.edu, or you can send regular mail to Todd Lester, P.O. Box 91, North Springs, West Virginia, 24869. That address again, Todd Lester, P.O. Box 91, North Spring, West Virginia, 24869. And in response to an environmental lawsuit and a new critical habitat designation, the U.S. Forest Service has agreed to reassess the impact of livestock grazing on hundreds of thousands of acres in the Gila River Basin of eastern Arizona and western New Mexico. 17 grazing allotments have been exempted from an earlier review brought about by lawsuits from the Center of Biological Diversity and the Forest Guardians. The U.S. Forest Service has concluded the allotments were, quote, not likely to adversely affect threatened and endangered species, even though they included already degraded loach, minnow, and spike dace habitat. This last April, the Center for Biological Diversity won a designation of 898 miles of river as critical habitat for those two species, and in the face of evidence of damage to habitat for the two imperiled fish, as well as the southwestern willow flycatcher and the Mexican spotted owl, the U.S. Forest Service filed papers with the court agreeing to submit the allotments to review by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Cattle may have to be removed from over 300 miles of public streams in the Gila River Basin since 1998 due to a series of suits by the Center and Forest Guardians. The suits were based on a series of Endangered Species Act petitions filed by the Center to protect imperiled aquatic and forest species in the upper and middle Gila watershed. The new review, which the U.S. Forest Service promises to begin this December, should lead to further grazing reductions. The agency has also indicated it will assess the impacts of livestock grazing on millions of acres of spotted owl habitat when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service completes mapping out critical habitat for that bird. And an international environmental study has pinpointed sources of cancer-causing dioxin found in the breast milk of Aboriginal women in Canada's Northlands. Scientists blame North American trash-burning incinerators, iron ore plants, copper smelters, and kilns for contributing to high levels of the chemical found in the diets of indigenous people of the Nunavut area in the eastern Arctic. The United States was the biggest contributor to the dioxin in the Northern Territory, said the report released by the Commission for Environmental Cooperation, an agency created by Canada, Mexico, and the United States under the North American Free Trade Agreement. The airborne agents enter the Inuit food chain through animals such as caribou, marine mammals, and fish, the chief food supply of the Inuit people of the North. And moving to Colorado, forest activists say that plans for reducing the wildfire risk in the Pike San Isabel National Forest near Deckers, Colorado, could lead to increased commercial logging. The U.S. Forest Service is proposing to thin small trees and underbrush in more than 20 square miles of forest, about 12% of the project area. The plan would introduce logging machinery into about 4 square miles of roadless forest where no logging roads have ever been constructed. Another 7 square miles will be clear-cut to create openings in the forest canopy to reduce the chances of fires spreading across the forest. The plan includes no limits on the size of the trees to be logged in many areas, which would allow the removal of larger old-growth trees, the ones most likely to survive a fire. Scientists have recommended that fire prevention projects protect large trees to provide habitat for dwindling forest wildlife such as northern goshawks. Instead, this plan would permit logging within the proposed critical habitat of the threatened Mexican spotted owl. It would also log parts of at least 3 inventoried roadless areas, including Gun Barrel, Green Mountain, and Thunder Butte areas. Forest Service Chief Mike Dombeck has proposed that restoration projects not log in roadless areas because of their low fire risks and high wildlife habitat values. Activists from the Wilderness Society and the Colorado Wild warn that the plan could set a precedent for other fire management projects. The groups recommend that the Forest Service produce a full environmental impact statement, including maps of roadless areas, and offer at least one alternative that does not log in those roadless areas. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for news on Earth First Radio today. If you want to get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzef@cruzio.com. That's cruzef@cruzio.com. Or you can send letters to Earth First Radio. We're at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, our address, Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And please be sure to send announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First Movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their current address is P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Once again, the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. And the first issue is free. You can listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, but only for another week. Then we go into Pacific Standard Time. Go to the website, www.microradio.net/FRSC. Download the player and listen in. There's lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz anytime you do. You can always find Earth First Radio archive shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net, and the software you need to play the MP3 files is free on the website. Earth First Radio is carried by a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to broadcast Earth First Radio, and that includes Austin Free Radio, who's back on the air. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, and portions of this newscast were prepared with the help of Stefan and Eon. If you'd like to help prepare Earth First News, contact us at our email address, cruzef@cruzio.com. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. And I'm Uncle Dennis. Thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to listen to Uncle Dennis's Earth First CD number 2. I believe the one we're going to listen to is The Power is turning. This is a Casey Neal song off of his first cassette called Paw Prints.
Serpent's eye. The power is turning. The power is turning. Rogue spirits are waiting, anticipating. Voices long forgotten again will awaken. The fire in the eye of the ego, deep and regal. No voice rivals the song of the past. At last, at last, at last, the power is turning. The wild sea is burning. Watch as it comes alive. A world is emerging. See it in the gleam of the serpent's eye. The power is turning. The power is turning. This is not the end of the world, it is only the beginning. An awakening, a reckoning, the nameless is returning. Rising from the western ocean, shining off the sea. Carried by a magic wind, alive again, alive again. The power is turning, the wild sea is burning. Watch as it comes alive. A world is emerging. See it in the gleam of the serpent's eye. The power is turning. The power is turning. The power is turning. The power.